The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to this June 6th, 2012 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm your host, Marie Stone. This is Writers on Writing. We are dedicated to the art and business of books. Barbara and I are here every single Wednesday morning with authors, poets. This morning it's a poet. Literary agents giving you the latest and most up-to-date information on the publishing world. I'm joined now by Hannah Barnaby, and coming up in the second half of the show, UCI professor and poet Susan Davis will be here talking about her poetry collection, I Was Building Up to Something. Hannah Barbary is a former children's book editor and bookseller. She has taught writing for children at Simmons College in Boston. Her novel is Wonder Show. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. She has been selected by IndieBound as one of their new voices for the spring of 2012, and the novel has been selected by Education.com as the top spot for middle school summer reading. It is my pleasure to welcome her this morning. Hannah, hi.
Hi.
Hi. So this... we were talking before the show, such a fun novel. I don't do a ton of children's literature on the show, and so this was a huge treat for me. So nobody can introduce the novel as well as the writer, so I'll give you a chance to talk about the origins of the book in your own head, kind of how it formed for you, where it came from, and a little bit about the story itself.
Sure, okay. I feel like it's maybe a little bit cliche to say this, but the truth is that the very first image of the book originated while I was sleeping. And I had a dream of a girl riding a bicycle, and I knew in the dream that she was trying to get away from someone. But that's sort of all of the information that I had when I woke up. And there was just something about the way that she looked and the urgency that she felt and the way that she was riding that kept her in my head. And it was about that same time that I got an opportunity to apply for a grant from the Boston Public Library. They had just started a children's writer-in-residence program, and there was a grant that came along with that. And so I decided to apply for the grant, and that was really the first time I sat down and thought, what could I do with that image? Who is this girl? What is she trying to get away from, and where is she going? And so that's sort of how I started to piece together Portia's story. And Wonder Show is the story of a girl, Portia, who has been left behind by a lot of people, mostly everyone in her family. She's been living at what's kindly called a home for wayward girls, but it's actually more of a fairy tale, Dickensian, dark place, and a traveling carnival comes by on a particular day, and it reminds her of her father and how much he loved the circus, and she decides to steal her keeper's bicycle and escape to the sideshow. Hmm.
Had you always planned to write a children's novel, or was it the impetus of this grant that sort of got you going in the dream, or was this always kind of in your head as something you were going to do?
Well, I have always loved children's books, and especially fiction for older children. You know, I don't know that I would always call them children, and yeah, the term young adult is sort of overused, I think, sometimes. But I guess I've always been intrigued by young adult fiction, and I did the children's literature graduate program at Simmons, and so my concentration really was always young adult fiction.
Okay, okay. And it was always your plan to delve into it and not just teach around it.
Yes. Well, yeah. I mean, to be honest, I started working in publishing as an administrative assistant. I was the assistant to the publisher at Houghton Mifflin, who at the time was Anita Sildy, who's a very well-known scholar of children's literature. And she really was the one who encouraged me to pursue writing. She really pushed me to enter the Vermont College program, mm-hmm. which is a graduate program and, you know, an MFA program in writing for children and young adults. And she also was the one who very presciently told me that at some point I would have to choose between being an editor and being a writer. And that may not be true for everyone, but it actually turned out to be true for me.
Yeah, yeah. You had mentioned earlier, and it was a good insight about the fairy tale nature of this wayward home for girls. And as I was reading the book, I was wondering if there was a structure that you were sort of guided by, separate and apart from structuring the narrative of the book, but more the the form of the book. If you were guided by a fairy tale, you know, form, if there was something, some other kind of classic archetype structure of novel writing that sort of gave you the shape of this book.
Sure. I think that stuff probably came in fairly organically. What I ended up doing during my time at the Boston Public Library, by the end of the residency, I was supposed to have a finished first draft, and there was a lot of other stuff going on in my life that was very unsteady, and so I ended up writing this book in a very non-linear way. I would get to the library, I had a little office space there, and I would sit down and I would just sort of start writing. I would think about Portia, and I would think about the other characters, and I would think, you know, who do I want to sort of visit today? So I was writing very short pieces as I went, and they were all out of order as I wrote them. And then the task much later was to put them in order and fill in many gaps
right.
in between. So I wouldn't recommend this approach to anyone because it was grueling at times, but I do think that it created a sort of ebb and flow that might not have been there had I, you know, started with chapter one, page one, and written straight through.
Yep.
And I definitely had those sort of fantasy elements in mind. I really wanted to create a world for Portia that was a little bit surreal
mm-hmm.
and a little bit fairy tale feeling, because I think a lot of young adult fiction is very focused on sort of hyper-realistic portrayal of kids with problems. And because of the setting and the time period, and I just really felt like Portia needed to be in a slightly more surreal place.
Yeah, yeah. It does have beautifully have that feel. I was wondering if you were writing it in fragments, because there are, you know, sort of these fun step-out chapters that, you know, most of the book is in third person, and then we'll get sort of first-person point of view from different characters' perspectives, and it did
and
have that.
And there was a time that I considered taking those out. A lot of those first-person pieces I was sort of writing for myself to get to know the characters a little bit better and give myself some more background for them, and I don't know that I always intended to keep them in. And even during the revision process, I spoke with my editor and said, you know, are these working? Do we need these? And I think a few people, you know, in reviews have said that they found them jarring, but then other people have said that they found them really sort of refreshing. So I think it really comes down to your personal approach and how willing you are to go in and out of a narrative that way.
Yeah. Well, I think it lends well to the fantasy, you know, I don't know, the mood of the piece, I guess I would say.
Yeah.
You know, as you're saying, you know, these kind of dark places and going in and out of people's heads and things, I think was really nice. You talk a little bit about your research process for this. There's a wonderful mm-hmm. author's note at the back of the book that, you know, gives a little bit of light into some of the research that you did on these, some of the circus characters, carnival characters. Talk a little bit about your research process and what that looked like.
Sure. The first thing I did when I got, when I was awarded the grant at the BPL and I got the first installment of money, is I went on Amazon and I ordered myself a whole bunch of books about carnivals and sideshows and the history of sideshows. And then I also read a lot of circus fiction to give myself an idea of how the subject had been treated by other writers. And I really just tried to immerse myself in the feeling of the culture of the sideshow around the time period in which Portia's living. And there's so much information, and I really didn't want it to be, you know, I didn't want my narrative to be overwhelmed by facts. I mean, there's so many interesting things that I was seeing, and I had to set some of those aside. But I did want to include some of these real people and some hints at their real stories, because it's remarkable how all of these people, you know, many of whom had extreme disabilities and birth defects and hardships, found a way to survive through this medium. Yeah. And then, of course, there were also people who took advantage of them. And I think that's a very current topic, and it's always relevant for teenage readers, you know, to read about this sort of search for community. And because I think, from what I remember of my teenage years, it was really a struggle to find people who I felt understood me and people I could feel connected to. And that's what really resonated with me as I read fiction and nonfiction set in the sideshow.
Right, right. That's a good point about how relevant it is for the young adult audience who's in their own sort of search for identity, trying to see the scope and range of other people struggling with extraordinary issues and how they, you know, in less forgiving time settings have made it. That's well observed. Was the time period in 1939 always sort of the setting you knew that this needed to be set in, and sort of the Dust Bowl era and that time period? What drew you to that?
Part of it was the story that I had heard from my own family members, my grandparents especially, about what they were doing at that time. And I felt, and as I did research and I found out more about the evolution and then the sort of breakdown of the whole circus sideshow system, it seemed like a really pivotal time in a lot of ways. You know, it was after the Depression, but before World War II, things were so much in transition, and the sideshow and circus cultures were really shifting along with everything else. It was really the end of the era for the small traveling shows to be able to survive. They really had to make adjustments, and the interest, there was beginning to be a sense of moral outrage at the idea of the sideshow, and so the people who had used that as a way to survive and find each other had to adjust to the idea that this is not going to continue.
Right, right. My guest this morning is Hannah Barnaby. The book is Wonder Show. It is published by Houghton Mifflin. And let's go back to this notion of writing in fragments, because I know a lot of writers who do this, who have already done this and who are sitting with a pile of, you know, 300 fragments and wondering how to put them together. And I'm wondering, because you have some really, you know, the chapters are relatively short. Some of them are really short. You have great titles for them. And I was wondering if you use the titles as much for yourself in putting together a structure after the fact and, you know, maybe storyboarded this or did something, you know, in the aftermath of how you piece this together. And maybe you can talk about that process.
Sure. It was after, you know, I had this first draft sitting around for a long time, and other things were going on. I got married, I had two kids, I was teaching and then not teaching, and I relocated with my family, and, you know, all the time, Portia was definitely still in the back of my mind, and it wasn't until I said, you know, I want to get back to this, and I had made contact with an editor who was willing to look at it, and that's when I really sat down with it again for the first time and read through the entire thing, and it was a huge mess. I mean, there were characters in vignettes that were said to be gone, and then they reappeared in other vignettes later on because I hadn't kept track. The chronology was a total disaster. So what I really had to do was decide which threads were going to carry the plot And, you know, that really, I think, is just a craft issue that comes up for anyone writing a novel. It's, you know, the decision of what are the most important motifs here, and how do I sustain those through from the beginning to the end. So a lot of things that are pretty major themes now in the finished product were still very much in the background when I started working with the draft again. So once I decided sort of what is Portia's goal and what is in her way and what does she have to do to get there, things started to make a little bit more sense. And a lot of the chapter titles as they are now are different than what they originally were. And I did use them, I would say, almost as mile markers for myself, to keep my eye on where I needed to go from point A to point B to C to D, and you know, weave those threads through so that it just made sense.
Right. Even dividing it up into parts, you know, the part one, part two, part three, to sort of give her distinct periods, you know, time periods of her life, probably. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's helpful to the reader as well, I suppose. But
yeah, and that's entirely connected to the location where she is. You know, the part two, right, it begins with her escape and ends with her being sort of reluctantly returned to the home, and then that kicks off part three.
Right, right. I want to give you a chance to read to us a little bit, because the book is so fun. The language is so fun. It's all great. Can you read to us a bit?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. So this is from a piece where she has arrived at the sideshow, and Jackal, who is the talker, so he's the one who stands on the midway and draws people into the sideshow by, you know, luring them verbally, and he's decided that he wants Portia to be his assistant, and he's just sort of had a revelation about how he's going to do that. So I'll start here. Quiet was not much of a possibility on the lot. There was always a symphony of sounds, even between shows, voices everywhere, truck motors and the hum of the generators, hammers pounding tent stakes, horses, elephants, tigers grunting in the heat, circus mothers calling circus children, the bell from the pie car pinging faintly in the wind, music from dozens of radios layering into one another, clustering like leaves on a branch, a steady combination of noises that equaled quiet, the ever-present purr in the background. And right now it was the sound of Jackal deciding Portia's future. She waited. Jackal paced. She waited some more. "Good girl," he said finally. "I think I've got it." "And?" "We'll switch places," he said. "You'll be the inside talker, and I'll do the bally. It's perfect, actually. I don't know why I didn't think of it before. I bring them in, you lead them through, and I meet you at the other end for the blow-off." "But what do I have to do?" "The Rubes will adore having a girl in there with them, a soft voice making them comfortable." Jackal was hopping around like a boy on Christmas morning. "Oh, the contrast between you and the ones on stage. We'll have Mrs. Collington make you a new dress, a white one. Oh, I'm breathless with the perfection of it. I think I need to sit down." "Jackal, what will I say?" "Just what I taught you. Same sad stories, only now you'll be standing right in front of the freaks." "I wish you wouldn't call them that." Jackal smirked. "What should I call them? The talent? The artists? They're people." "Darling, we're all people. That's not the point. There are three parts of the Wonder Show. The human marvels, the freaks, and the talkers. We all know who we are in the show, and who we are when the show is over." He jabbed a finger at the bally line. "This is the show, and this show has freaks. You see?" "Yes, I see." Jackal shook his head. "No, you don't. Not yet, but you will." He leaned in and tapped the tip of her nose. "Once you're inside." Resisting the urge to slap his hand away, Portia smiled sweetly and did not move. In her time with Jackal, indeed in her time with the entire show, she had learned it was better to conceal her thoughts until the right moment. She was a guest here, a temporary passenger, and she could not leave too large a mark. Mister had surely sent someone to fetch her by now. She could not risk offending those who were willing to help her hide, even if they didn't know or want to know whom she was hiding from. "Just a little more time," she thought as she made her way to the pie car. "I'll find Max, I know it. I just need a little more time." Mm-hmm.
That was Hannah Barbary reading from Wonder Show. So fun. There are so many kind of, you know, vile, not vile characters, but bad pretty bad behaving characters in here.
Sure.
And I'm wondering how you accomplish treating people with sort of a, you know, gentle, fair hand, because I think, you know, all characters are interesting when they're three-dimensional, and these people certainly are. So I'm wondering if there were characters who gave you a particular amount of trouble because they were, you know, such vile personalities, or kind of how
well,
you...
Well, Jackal is certainly a fun character to play with. I mean, I think he's sort of unapologetically opportunistic, and he has found just the right context for himself to be that way. I mean, they're definitely, when you're writing for young adults, children of any age, you know, there's always a little bit of a question in your mind, I think, about responsibility. And am I going too far here? You know, do I need to set a good example? And but I think the best fiction and the fiction that resonates most with young readers is honest about the fact that not everyone is a good person. You know, there are questionable people who try to do good things, and I think what Portia finds with this group is that they're a challenge to her. They're not immediately, you know, oh, come here and we'll help you, and, you know, they all have their own agendas, and they all have their own problems, and but in a way that makes it a better place for her to be, because she doesn't, they don't ask her a lot of questions. You know, everyone has their own stories, and they keep to themselves. And but ultimately, they are bonded because of that.
Yeah. Were there particular people that were harder, you know, in the early parts of the book where she's at the Wayward Home and, you know, and
yeah.
Sophia and some of these people that were mean?
You know, like Caroline was hard for me because I didn't want her to seem just like this wishy-washy victim kind of person.
Yeah.
And she, you know, was a pretty strong contrast to Portia. And then I also didn't want Portia to seem too harsh and too uncaring because Caroline was so sweet. So I think that most of the challenge was in balancing the characters with each other, not that there was a particular one who was difficult to work with, but that it was difficult to get them all in a scene together and keep them working with each other. Sort of like making a movie, I guess, where you put all the different personalities together and you hope that everyone will be willing to accommodate a little bit and you know, and cooperate with your plan.
Right, right. And you had mentioned earlier, and I think it's well observed, sort of the, in the back of your mind when you're writing for young adults or children or this age group, responsibility in portraying characters in a, you know, realistic, honest way. Are there other principles that guide you specifically as children's writer that, that kind of resonate in your mind either with language or with subject matter or, you know, things that you, you feel like you have to be on the lookout for when you're writing for this age group?
Yeah. Sometimes I think there are, but I find that that comes up more in the editing process and the revision process than the initial writing process. Because when I'm writing a story, I don't think to myself, okay, I am writing this story for this age reader. I'm not really thinking about the reader in particular, and I don't always intend to write for a certain age group. It just sort of happens that way. And Anita Sylvie, whom I worked with at Houghton Mifflin, used to say that she always thought children's writers wrote for the age at which they got stuck in some way. So I suppose that means that I'm stuck at, say, 15, 14 or 15. And it's just the direction that I end up going in. Even I have tried numerous times because I have young children now, and I think, oh, it would be so much easier if I could write picture books because they're just so much shorter that they must be easier, which I know is not the case at all. If there are picture book writers listening, I know that it's not easy. and yet, I just, it's a real struggle for me to think on that level, and I just sort of organically, I think, go to a teenage place.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
so
such
it's more in the revision process that I might comb through and say, this doesn't, you know, really, if it doesn't work for the book, if it's not true to the story, then it jumps out at me. But in terms of audience, you know, I think we don't give our audience enough credit a lot of the time. I think that if the right book finds the right reader, then it will all be okay.
Yeah. It would be a fantastic movie. It's so visual, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I don't.
I would love that.
Yeah.
I think I would love that.
Did you, I assume that you really saw it in your head as you were writing it, because it is so visual and so beautifully described, this this world.
Yeah. I did, and I had a few pictures sort of up in my writing space, just to get myself in the setting. You know, when you go away from your workspace and then you come back to it, sometimes it's that reentry can be a little bit difficult, and so I find that having some period photographs help, and then music too. If I listen to the same music as I'm writing, even if it's not of that time period, it just is part becomes part of the routine. So I can kind of get myself back into the right place. And I definitely had a strong sense of atmosphere while I was writing.
Yeah, yeah. Sadly, we have drawn down on our time, but this was a lovely book and lovely lovely to talk to you. Thank you so much for taking the time this morning.
Oh, thanks so much for inviting me.
That was Hannah Barbary, the book, Barnaby. The book is Wonder Show. You can find it's for sale everywhere. Like I said, it's published by Houghton Mifflin, and you can find her online and learn more about Hannah. Hopefully we'll see more from her in the near future. That's a really, really fun book. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with me. Susan Davis will be here for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, and we will be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. You can visit iTunes. We are under College News, College Radio. You can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com. www.thewriterscoach.com for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. We had a fantastic speaker series event last night at the Scape Gallery. Three fantastic novelists and short story writers joined us last night. I think she podcast these. Somebody was there to record them. So if you missed out last night, you might want to watch for information on the podcast later on down the road. And more of those events are always coming up. So keep your eye on that website. They do sell out fairly quickly. Completely full house last night. So be sure and get your tickets early on. They are fantastic events. Again, I'm your host, Marie Stone, and I'm joined now by Susan Davis. Susan Davis's poetry reflects a birth in Louisiana, a childhood in upstate New York, and stints in the giant states of Texas and Alaska. She now resides in California with her husband and directs undergraduate creative writing right here at UCI. Her poem, The Seasons Begin in the Waiting Room, was chosen for the 2010 Rebecca Land Poetry Award. And the poem Farm Days was installed in a windscreens at the Lake June Transit Station in Dallas in November of 2010. I Was Building Up to Something is the collection we are discussing today. It's published by Moontide Press. It's my huge pleasure to welcome her this morning. Susan, hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thank you for coming on. What a gorgeous collection. It reminded me that I don't read enough poetry, and I don't slow down enough to spend time with it. So this was a real, real treat. I want to give you a chance to introduce the collection. Talk about how these poems originated, sort of the time period over which you wrote them, how you knew they gelled together as a collection as opposed to separate poems, and a little bit about how the collection came to be.
Well, I think I wrote the first of these in about 1996, maybe. Mm. I had been a stay-at-home mom and with a background in teaching high school English. And so, sometimes I get moved, I'm sorry. No. My daughter went to kindergarten. I thought, I'm not going to stay home and feel sorry for myself. So so I went over to Long Beach City College and got into Frank Gaspar's workshop there. And then after a couple of years, he said, you need to go to graduate school. So I did. That's where it all started. But I had written in college and then had kept journals in between, but not sending anything out much. So the poems that I started writing towards the end of that little stint over at City College and then on into the graduate program at UCI were the first poems in the book, some of the first older poems in the book. So that would have been 1996. So the book was a long time coming along. And then it took me some years to find somebody who wanted to publish it, actually. So that's the lifetime of them. In terms of whether or not, yes, there are many left on the cutting room floor, of course. And then as I began to look at what I had that I knew I liked, you know, I don't know how it works for other people, but I put mine in a drawer and I come back and look at it 3 months later, 6 months later, a year later, and see if it still interests me. And I figured the ones that are still interesting to you are the ones you collect, and the rest of them, maybe they'll work out later.
Yeah.
Or maybe they're just dead and they will never be resurrected. So
I don't know if
that answers your question.
Yeah, I always think it's interesting to write over a period of, you know, 15 years, looking back over what you wrote 15 years ago. Everybody would be a different person. Their areas of concern would be different. Their perspective on life would be different. And so to look back over something that you wrote, and poetry is so intensely personal, it strikes me. So to look back over something that you wrote 15 years ago, you know, as a different person and have that kind of fresh perspective, but to see if the poetry holds up, you know, as some sort of truth, I think is really What a great test, you know, nothing tests poetry better than the test of time, I suppose.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah.
Even if the time frame you're working with is your own sensibility, I do think there are people, I think people would be surprised if they journaled and they went back to things they wrote, even when they were children or adolescents. I think they would find touchstones that haven't really changed that much. I mean, sure, you grow into things, but you can also be surprised by perceptions you had that weren't fully realized, maybe, but you were onto something.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's important. I think that, well, now we're getting into another topic, but I think that's why it's important for people, whether they turn into actual poems or not, I think that's why it's important for people to jot down things from time to time and go back to them. I think they can be illuminating.
That's a really good point. I was talking to a writer yesterday who's just finished, actually like 5 years ago, she finished a novel on Keats. And she said, I was just digging through my garage and I found these old papers from high school and I don't remember anything about them except I was writing about Keats. And she said, I can't believe he's been in my head for, you know, 45 years. That's unbelievable.
I think it is surprising. I think people forget. I mean, you talk about, you know, looking back and thinking about things. I think sometimes people aren't real clear about what they were thinking back then because they didn't write it down. You can look at videos of yourself. I mean, I do that. I've seen those before with my family when my children were small. But I sometimes take things I wrote down when my children were quite small and they'd say something very interesting or we'd have a conversation I thought was worth, you know, keeping track of. And my daughter just turned 24 and she's in South Africa. And I sat down with her, what had been her baby book, and found things I'd written about her when she was 4 and 6 that were absolutely what she's doing now, you know.
Wow.
So I just think it's important to, you know, chronicle. I think that's part of what's important about writing.
Yeah, right. Tell me how much you feel, because you teach here at our program, you've obviously gone through the MFA program and spent a lifetime of studying poetry. And it always strikes me that poetry, as opposed to, I mean, all writing is a little bit hard to teach, I would think. But, you know, I always feel like poets are sort of born, you know, instead of made. And I'm wondering how that process goes, how much of people's poetry you can shape as professor, and how much of it is, you know, just kind of organic to the person. Does that make sense?
Well, no, it makes perfect sense. I was an artist, and a lot of people thought that's what I would end up doing, going to college in art, but I ended up going to college, my undergraduate, on a full scholarship for classical voice. So I grew up with art and music and literature, and I think that it's not, I think from person to person, there are several things involved. One is people's natural ability, of course. I mean, some people just are born, you know, with a big head start.
Yeah, right, right.
And they just have a gift for it. But I don't think that means that it's not also a good idea for a child to take some kind of instrument and be involved in some kind of sport and do, you know, try to paint or draw or do something, because for whatever you have in place, it's going to enrich you if you develop it. You learn things about yourself because it has to be art. The arts have to do with your perspective on the world and how you see it and what you see. And so I think there are things that get developed in people while they're doing that. So to get back to your question, I tell my students this explicitly. I say, you know, you have a certain amount of ability, and what is that in poetry? It's being able to hear things musically in your ear in terms of what the language can do. And then it's what you know. You know, if you don't add something to that, it's kind of weightless, you know, it doesn't have any kind of substance to it, so you have to pay attention to things. And then once you decide what it is you care about, then go learn more about it. You know, if I pick out a flower, if there's a flower I want, then I want to see what the root systems do. So I have my little book that I look up, or if there's a certain bird I want to, then I have my Audubon bird book or something. I don't really end up caring that much whether my students are writing brilliant poems. I mean, if someone is going to be good and they have the discipline and the desire to work hard to make it come to pass, then I want to be alongside them when they're doing that. But the students who just want to, you know, dip their toes in the water, or I want to think that whatever they choose to go into, in terms of professions and life work and so on, I feel strongly that their study of poetry and learning how to read and see something from the point of view of a person who's writing it is as much important as the ones who end up writing the poems well.
Right.
I don't know if that answers your question, but
yeah. No, it does.
I kind of just see myself as a guide, and I tell them that. I was taught, you know, to draw and to play piano and to do those things by a teacher, an individual teacher. I wasn't in classes with other people, so my training was one-on-one. So that's hard for me to do sometimes because I have so many students. But I do whatever I can to make it personal and individual, because I don't think you can develop a skill any other way, especially with something that's asking people to bring something they don't even know is there. Sometimes you just have to dig.
That's right, yeah.
You know, help them dig to find out what they care about or what they're interested in. That's the hardest thing, because they think you have an idea what you want them to do or say, and they just have to read your mind and figure out what it is. And I really want to know what they think, and it takes them a long time to believe me.
Right.
But I really do want to know.
Right. Why don't you just tell me the answer?
Yeah, well, and right. Nobody, a lot of times people haven't asked them that yet. They've just given, you know.
Well, the thing that strikes me about poetry, and I mean, how you do so much in so little, and, you know, the placement of every line and how it looks on the page and where the, you know, where the line breaks are, where the breaths are taken, everything has so much meaning in a poem. I can see as a student when you're just getting started with this, you know, the rules feel amorphous. When it works so beautifully, but trying to define that magic seems really hard. And, you know, I can see where they feel like they're wandering around. What's that quote about wandering around an attic in the dark with full of scissors or something that they...
That's kind of scary.
Right. That must be sort of the feeling of getting started in poetry, of, you know, feeling like you know, because when it's bad, it's so bad. And when it's beautiful, it's so perfect, you know, and trying to find where that line is hard. I mean,
I agree.
My deep admiration for poets. It's an amazing thing when it works well. Now, I'm wondering if maybe you can read one of these for us, and we can sort of talk about one of these a little bit. Is there one that's your favorite to read?
Oh, I have lots of favorites.
Me too. Me too.
Why don't I ask you what you would like to hear?
Well, I really did love Undertaking.
Okay.
Yeah, there's so many I loved, but that one stood out to me. And let's do that one. Let's do that one.
Okay. That was originally the name of the book, you know.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Anyway.
Was that one of the earlier poems that you wrote?
Actually, yes. It was written my second year in workshop at UCI.
Wow.
It's a divorce poem, by the way.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Okay. Shall I read it then?
Please, yeah. Please.
Okay. Undertaking. She had to wash away the black silk worked into his pores, into the wrinkles around his eyes that made him look older than his 47 years. She walked his naked length on the table at her waist where she kneaded dough, where she told the men to place him. She had given them the children and made them all leave. She took her time. By lantern light, she washed each finger, cleaning underneath the nail with the splinter sheath and cotton. She started once to wrap him in a blanket. He was so cold. She found a mole on his hip she never knew was there. I thought he would have liked to have her find the mole like this when he was still alive. I said to you, when the husband died, the way it's done now, they make her leave the room, leave the body with a stranger who zips it up in a plastic bag, tags it like a specimen, puts this warm, sweet body in a drawer. They let a stranger handle you that one last time. They would have to drug me. They would have to drag me away. Remember how I told you that?
That was Susan Davis reading from her collection, I Was Building Up to Something, the poem was Undertaking. So tell me about it being a divorce poem. I had read it, you know, three or four times before you read it this time, and obviously I hadn't seen it that way. Tell me about the origins of the poem and some of your thoughts about writing it.
Well, before I do that, I want to say I hope it doesn't take away other people's applications for it, because I feel like sometimes it doesn't really matter why a person wrote a poem. Yeah. And I had a woman who came in on this conversation, and she said, my mom died a year ago, and I wished that we had had her at home, and, you know, that we had had that leisure time that I had been able to spend with the body instead of just being hustled out of the hospital room and saying, well, that's it, that's over. And it is about that, you know, that just because it wasn't, that wasn't where it was when I was writing it. It was actually that I was trying to find a way to bury the marriage, and it wasn't something I had opted, you know, to have end. And I hadn't made a public vow before. So the only way to, you know, to me, I don't think I realized this at the time, but it was, I think it was a way for me to disavow, you know, to, the only way you can do that is if you're no longer, if it's dead, and so therefore you're not obligated to, by your word, to be. So I think that's why I didn't know it at the time. I don't plan things that way. I think the best poems should surprise you after you're reading them later, and somebody points out something, you go, well, what do you know?
Right.
That is there, and I did write that, but I certainly, and it is true, but I didn't know it.
Right.
At the time, so.
It's funny you say that, because we were talking last night at the Speaker Series event about how to get to the best way to get to emotional truths is through fiction, and is through completely changing the facts of the event to get to the raw, you know, underpinnings of what the driving force of the feeling was. And the more that you try to stick to the facts of the situation, the more it erodes the emotional truth of it. And that strikes me as particularly true here, that you know, to get to the feeling of it, you have to go through a metaphor or through, you know, an alternate back door in order to try and capture the emotion around the event.
Well, the scene, one of the reasons, I'm a very visual person, one of the reasons, if the original stanza, I mean the first stanza rings true, it's because it's a scene from a movie with Sally Field and I think Danny Glover, called Places in
Heart. Right, yeah.
And at the very beginning of the movie, her husband has a heart attack in the cotton fields, and they do this, they bring the body in, and she dresses it for burial. And I was at that movie with my ex-husband, and I did say something like that to him. So that's what kind of I was obviously very touched, because I don't think I've seen that movie again. I keep it intending to go back and look at it, and I think, well, maybe I shouldn't.
Maybe you shouldn't, yeah.
Maybe I messed it up. Maybe it doesn't evoke that at all, but, it doesn't matter over time.
Right. It doesn't matter.
Think what you need for them to be, I guess.
Right. Yeah, and it strikes me, as I said earlier, just the line breaks, the way the poem is on the page, where the stanzas break, all of it. I wish our listeners could be sitting here looking at it alongside us, because I think that's part of the experience of it as well. But
well, they can always buy the book.
They should absolutely buy the collection. Yes. Unfortunately, we're drawing down on our time, but I also wanted to talk a little bit about, so many of the poems are about loss, and that's just, maybe this only shows my bias towards what I'm interested in reading, but those were that's the subject area that draws me. And I know there are a lot of poems about, all kinds of happy things as well, but the sense of loss balanced against the sense of nature and kind of rebirth and light, and getting that balance right within the collection itself, obviously, was gorgeously mastered as well. Do you have any thoughts about, kind of balancing things correctly to sort of give the dark and the light and the gravity versus the sort of pure beauty of it, and insights into that for any poets we have in our listening audience?
Well, I guess I'm always interested in, I think things stay interesting to me if they don't get buried, in one thing. That's just, I don't know whether that means I have attention deficit disorder or what, but I don't stay with any one thing for very long before I want it to have, to make a different turn. And that's just my interest. So I do that with, when I write a poem, an individual poem, I'm interested in there being balance. If poems are generally description, narrative, song, and argument, or a combination of those four things. So if a poem is starting out to be primarily descriptive, then when it makes the turn to do whatever it's going to do next, whether that's some kind of a thoughtful treatise or whatever it turns out to be, I want to look at the balance between those two things and decide if I stay really engaged in the description or does it go on too long. I mean, they might be great lines, but are there too many of those? Do I need to cut back on those so the poem moves on and it doesn't get bogged down anywhere? And I guess then you can expand that about the book as well. If there are too many family poems or two poems that take up a lot of the same points, then I'll take those two and set them down side by side and see if they can't become one poem. So that you don't stay too long in any one place and then feel like it's gone on too long. I mean, that's what you don't ever want, is someone to get bored, including yourself. I mean, starting with me, I don't want to get bored, So I don't know if that answers your question, but it's something that I'm always aware of.
Yeah, it does. Susan, this is, it's a gorgeous collection, and like I say, I just bow down to the mastery of poets. I don't know how it's done, but I know when it's done well. So it's this was just beautiful. Thanks so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you.
That was Susan Davis. She is a creative writing professor here at UCI. She is a gorgeous poet. The collection is I Was Building Up to Something. It's published by Moontide Press. You can find more about Susan online. Obviously, the book is available online, and really stunning. Like I say, I'm just in awe of that form. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning, 9 o'clock. Barbara will be with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.
Something told me it was over.
away from me, child. So you see, I love you so much that I don't want to watch you leave me, babe. Most of all, I just don't want to be free, no.
Lasta ver KUCI 88.9 FM, Cuyabá.
Estás escuchando a KUCI 88.9.
Услушьте KUCI.
Vous écoutez la radio KUCI 88.9 FM.
You're listening to 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine.
Welcome to today's lottery drawing. And today's winning numbers are not yours, not yours, and another number that's not yours. And the final number is not yours.
When it comes to having...